Welcome to the 467th episode of the Jamie Delaney Plant-Based Wellness Podcast. My name is Jamie Delaney, and I'm your host. I'm a plant-based cardiologist and endurance athlete living in Southwest Florida. Thanks for listening. We're having a little bit of summer down here. We've hit 80s and had some humidity. So last week's longish run, the longest I've had since my 100, 10 milers, we're a little bit on the hot and humid side. So that was a nice twist and something new to train for. So it's great to have a little difference in the temperature. Today had a little bit of rain on the start. Still have a little humidity, but not quite as warm. So I guess we're entering into summer this week end, I guess we spring ahead, so we'll have a little bit more daylight in the evening to do a little bit more training, so that'll be good. My training plan is to slowly build up the mileage while still trying to heal my right ankle injury. Just a matter of tendonitis and, some gnarly inflammation from running in the mud, I guess, is about where we are. Some days better than others. Have not had a pain-free running day as of yet, but tolerable. There are some pain-free moments. Luckily, the discomfort moves around. Sometimes it's on the outside of my ankle. Sometimes it's on the middle of my ankle. Sometimes it's up my shin a little bit. Sometimes it's in my Achilles. So I think there's a lot of systems at play, but it kind of throws off my gait, which kind of makes other things worse a little bit as well. Doing my rehab, exercise to strengthen my foot, exercises to increase my foot mobility, strengthen my calves, and then whatever it takes for Leadville as far as strength work goes. So the motto is, what's going to make me stronger for Leadville? So I don't miss my strength workouts these days. It's what can I do to, again, get my legs ready for a lot of climbing and a lot of descending. It's also mental preparation. I got asked today by my nurse, maybe you should just give it a couple days off or a week off and let your ankle actually have some time off. But something tells me things are going to not feel that great come middle of Leadville. I'm not sure when things will start not feeling good, but as long as I can keep going, I'm going to keep going, and there's going to be some discomfort. So kind of got to get used to having things just not perfect, whether it be the weather or my ankle or my gait. So it's a little bit of mental preparation as far as handling things at this point as well. Visualization about how things are going to be. So I'm trying to do a little bit of all that in preparation. I even tried a new rehab therapy this week, localized cryotherapy. So it is nitrous oxide. So what the dermatologists use to burn things off your skin, I guess. But this is concentrated in a wand of sort that blows minus 200 degree Fahrenheit nitrous oxide towards the affected part, hence my ankle, with a little laser pointer. It's pretty interesting. I usually don't go for things along that line, but again, this injury is nagging and I'm trying to get rid of it any way I can. At first I thought, well, I'm just going to stick my foot in a bucket of ice and that'd be my cryotherapy. I'm a little bit of an ice weenie when it comes to that, so I put my foot in a bucket of ice water and then added the ice. It was still hard to take much more than a couple of minutes. Then in and out. But this was actually fairly pleasant. My ankle bone definitely got cold, but not near as bad as if you've ever jumped into cold 55 degree water or, in the ocean when it's cold, how your bones kind of ache a little bit. That, just the beginning of that maybe, but nothing, and you could actually feel coolness penetrating in the skin. And the idea, this is nitrous oxide, penetrates into the skin and pushes the lymph and fluids back to where they should be and to reduce swelling and inflammation. That's the thought process of the whole thing. So I have to tell you that, when I came out of that, lasted, the therapy session was probably 5 or 10 minutes tops, and I came out feeling better. Like you come out of the ice, things are numbed up a little bit perhaps. But the swelling was definitely somewhat improved. I've been starting to be a little bit more religious, taking some turmeric to decrease inflammation. But, you know, I got to think that things were a little bit better today. So I probably go for a second session to see how things are going to play out. So kind of exciting. I may actually have to have the cryotherapist on the podcast so we can talk about it further. If I get this, you know, quick cure that we all look for. So, as you know, I follow some carnivore people on Instagram to see their trials and tribulations and watch how they throw plant-based people under the bus. And sometimes I throw plant-based people under the bus if I don't think they're acting completely legitimate, so to speak. But the carnivore update for this week is apparently it's hard for those four folks to travel as well. So you hear people saying, I can't stay plant-based because I can't go out to dinner and I can't find anything to eat. It's hard to go out with your friends. It's hard to find something on the menu. And so that's why plant-based people say they can't do it. Well, it turns out the carnivore people are having the similar problem. There's been some complaints. It's hard to travel. There's actually vegetables lacing their meat. There could be some panko in their burger or in their sausage. Turns out they have trouble finding things at a gas station as well. You know, I think I talked about in the last plant-based podcast that I did that, you know, you go into a big service station, you're looking around, certainly there's something here that's okay, and typically there's not. Well, it turns out there's not many carnivore options at a service station either. They can't eat the chips and all the junk food and the candy and all that kind of stuff. And there's not very many hunks of meat laying around for them. Probably the best they can do is to get like a Lunchable or something along those lines. So it's not that easy for them either. And it's certainly hard to find, you know, a piece of liver laying around at a gas station or at a nice restaurant. They also say it's hard to snack with friends, and one alluded to having a pint of beer with friends. I don't know if they realize that beer is made from hops, which is a grain, which is basically liquid bread. So I guess that has to be a cheat day for them. So it's not all it's cracked up to be a carnivore. And turns out most of those people succumb and have, you know, their sweet treats and their potato chips and pizza days and ice cream days. So it is very difficult when you go to the far ends of the spectrum when you eat. I had that conversation today with someone because eating plant-based, to me, makes eating healthy easier because I have all the healthy foods being plant-based. I have the main ingredient where people are lacking is fiber. So I want to get all the fiber I can, and I'm going to eat all the plants that I can. But I need to exclude the animal products, the dairy and the eggs and the meat. And of course, it's easy to see if there's a piece of chicken, pork or beef or fish laying on your plate, but sometimes, you know, whether there's eggs in something or if there's always eggs in some pastries or the oils and things or dairy lacing things that you wouldn't expect it to be laced with can make it somewhat difficult. So there's some label reading that has to go on unless you eat, for the most part, plants, fruits, and vegetables and whole grains. And then there's not much reading involved. If you make your own, there's not much reading involved. But to me, it's an easy lifestyle because when I said I'm going to eliminate animal products, that means that I'm going to eliminate animal products so I don't have to worry. And there's a natural caloric restriction that goes with eating a higher carbohydrate, 4 calories per gram, and protein, 4 calories per gram, and limiting fat, which is 9 calories per gram. So to me, it makes perfect sense. It's healthy. I get plenty of fiber, plenty of antioxidants. I recover well. There's no downsize. One of the things that I have to agree with carnivore people when it comes to vegans is how we present being vegan or plant-based on social media. Typically, the athletes are very low-key about being plant-based, so they're not, you know, running with a big vegan shirt on or being plant-based. It's pretty quiet. They know they've got their game going on. They don't care about what other people do. They're just focused on their own health and well-being. So the people that are broadcast are typically the people that might not represent a healthy plant-based person, or maybe make it attractive on social media for people to be plant-based. I saw a post by a well-known cardiologist alluding to a very well-known how not to family practice doctor. And in the background, they had these elderly people doing, they were jogging, and they had one person with a number, but it was a fake bib number, like they were in a race, but it wasn't a race. It was just a shot to show elderly people chasing elderly people with one person having a bib on it. To me, that's not going to really attract anybody to the plant-based lifestyle. And I think that really does a big disservice to plant-based nutrition. I think to attract more people, we got to take the nerd hats off and start saying, hey, this is a great way to live. You can have a lot of fun. You can be healthy. You can be athletic. You can be outdoorsy. No big deal. It's not about being 90 pounds, walking on the treadmill continuously, and counting your blueberries. That's why I thought the movie Game Changers was such a great movie, because it had athletes, it had people from all walks of life, it had young people. So it wasn't, billed as, wait till you get old, eat plant-based, because you need every advantage you have to keep from dying, so to speak. So if we're going to be healthy plant-based eaters, we need to take on some physical assessment to see how we're doing. First thing you can do is stand on one leg. 20% of 60-year-olds cannot stand on one leg. 50% of 70-year-olds cannot stand on one leg. Only 10% of 80-year-olds can stand on one leg. If you can stand on one leg, there is a 90% 7-year survival. There's only a 65% chance of a 7-year survival if you can't stand on one leg. It's worse than that if you can't stand on both legs. You might want to give this a try because it's a little more difficult than you think. If you've had a recent lower extremity injury, like my ankle, I can stand on my left foot all day long and put my toe socks on, but my right foot is a little bit more unstable. The tendons start to hurt and I get a little wobbly. But one of the ways that you can practice this is do a touch support. So stand by something that you can just touch with your fingers, not hold on to, because that makes you lean one way or another. But a little touch test can help you start to gain more confidence in standing on one leg. And you can also assess, and that's what we do in our practice, what's the problem that you can't stand on one leg? Is it because you don't activate your glutes? Is it a foot stiffness because the bones in our foot have to move? Is it a knee issue, proprioception issue from neuropathy? So there's a whole host of reasons why our balance starts to go. It could be cerebral, in our back lobe, our cerebellum of our brains. If there's an issue there, our balance starts to go. People with Parkinson's, those are neuropathies. If you have a diabetic neuropathy, it's going to be much harder to stand on one foot. So there's a lot of reasons why people can't, but you should assess them or have somebody assess them so you can get this under control, because it's pretty important. The other thing is your overall aerobic fitness. So how fit are you to be able to burn carbohydrates, burn fat, exercise at a conversational pace, so to speak. And one way that you can assess that is a 12-minute run. So you warm up and you run 12 minutes for as fast as you can. And there are some calculators online which you can calculate your VO2 max. Although I love my Garmin and iWatches, and a lot of watches have VO2 max, they may not be quite as accurate as you like. So I would correlate your watch with the old Cooper time and true tested calculation of VO2 max with a run test if possible. If you have a watch that gives you your VO2 max, and the VO2 max is your ability to take up oxygen, you can track it for improvements. Because one thing the watch can do, it will track your numbers over time, just like body battery and heart rate variability. So you can see improvements. It may not be the most accurate number, but certainly the trend would be important. a, for instance, VO2 max category. We'll probably start the 40 to 49 age for women. Less than 26 would be very low. 37 to 46, very high. If you were 40 to 49 in a man, less than 34 would be low. 44 to 51 would be high. Moving up, 50 to 59-year-old females, again, less than 25 is bad. The only time you're, it's good to be under 20, well, I guess over 20 is, would be good, is if you're over 80. So if you get all the way up to 80, you can, your VO2 max less than 15 is bad. Above average is 20 to 22. 60 to 69, to be good, your VO2 max above average should be 25 to 29. High would be 30 to 39. And again, males, 50 to 59, 36 to 40 would be above average, 41 to 49 would be high. 60 to 69, 30 to 35 would be above average, and 36 to 45. So you can compare that with your watch and do the 12-minute test and get an idea of how things are going along that line. Push-ups. These are the real ones from your hands and your feet with your elbows bent, bringing your chest down to the ground and all the way extending up with your elbows straight. If you can do 10 of those, which is the magic number, it is associated with an improved survival. 40 push-ups, 96% chance of, 96% less likely to die than those who cannot do 10. So someplace between 10 and 40 is the magic number, but if you can work on doing 10 good push-ups, that's overall body strength, which is a very good sign of muscular fitness. I will give you a hint. Engaging your abs is the key. So when you're in a plank position, you can start from your elbows if you want to practice the plank, but you want to bring your pubic bone forward to engage your abs, push your ribs down towards the floor so that your abdominal muscles are engaged and connecting your ribs to your pelvis. That makes your body a unit, and you'll see it's much easier to do a push-up than just standing and trying to, or just having going from a plank position and letting your arms do all the work. So people that are athletes, if you look at people doing calisthenics, they engage the core before they start these activities. Next one is grip strength. If your grip strength is less than 16 for a woman or less than 26 for a man, that is defined as weakness. If it's greater than that, you have a less than 50% chance of dying at 10 years. The next is blood pressure. Everybody would probably guess that one. 20 points increase in systolic blood pressure is the equivalent of having twice the risk of stroke or heart attack. So knowing what your blood pressure is and getting it under control. Some people say they have white coat hypertension, which means that when they get excited, they increase their sympathetic tone, anxiety, their blood pressure increases. It's just not the white coat, it's everything. So that means anything that stirs people up that are very sympathetically driven are more likely to have high blood pressure. So sometimes, people's blood pressure end up being higher most of the day than not. So it's very important to know perhaps what is driving your particular blood pressure and, you know, focus in on that. So some people have more trouble regulating salt and water retention. Some people eat a high salt diet that leads to salt and water retention. So changing your diet is good for everyone, but if you eat out a lot, that can drive it. So sometimes just fixing that can improve your blood pressure. Some people have underlying vascular disease, so they don't make nitric oxide, so increasing your greens will cause vasodilation. Exercise is going to increase your sympathetic tone acutely, but then you have an increased parasympathetic tone afterwards, so that's how it results in lowering your blood pressure. So exercise is very important to incorporate. And then breathing, because if you breathe from your diaphragm, you activate your vagus nerve and ultimately can lower your blood pressure and heart rate that way. So again, it's good to assess what the problem is, not necessarily, you see, I just didn't jump to medication. What is it that we can do to reverse the underlying cause as opposed to just treat with a medication? It was kind of funny. When I went down in the cryotherapy places in the first floor of my building. So I went down to see them and see what they had to offer down there. And I sat there for 5 or 10 minutes to get my therapy. And I left feeling good. And it's like, you know, I'm in the wrong business because these people are doing a 5 or 10 minute therapy session. If you get a whole body cryo, and that's a topic for another day, it's like 1 to 3 minutes. You know, some other things are very short acting. So you pay them cash to feel good in a pretty short amount of time. On the other hand, if you're working with me, I'm going to have you do all the work. You have to change your lifestyle. And it's not a quick fix. So no wonder, you know, we don't have people pounding down the doors to join the plant-based movement and the exercise movement because they have to, you know, actually change what they're doing or move a little bit. So that was a little disappointing, but I think in the end, even with cryotherapy, it made my ankle feel better, but I have to address what I did. So yeah, I, you know, got my shoes stuck in the mud and was pulling on it for hours on end and slipping and sliding in the mud and, you know, ran 100 miles. So yes, I did damage to my ankle, but I did damage to my, not everybody had that. So I did damage to my ankle because it wasn't strong enough and I had imbalances that I need to address. And so that's really at the core. I need to get out of pain, but the core is that I need to assess what's going on with my ankle and address those areas. So I do, you know, toe raises. I do eversions and inversions, and I do mobility with my calf and strengthening with my calf. So I have to do those because I know that I'm going to be prone to that injury again. I can't have the cryo machine delivered 12,000 feet on Hope Pass to help me with my aching ankles when it comes to Leadville. So the idea is to make myself stronger and avoid these injuries to start with. And if you're thinking right now, whether if you just didn't move as much or you just didn't do as much and you were really careful and you sat still, would you not get injured and couldn't everything be okay? But the reality of it is just sitting around not doing anything, trying to protect yourself or avoid yourself, avoid danger or avoid infection or avoid confrontation, whatever it happens to be, we deteriorate. So if we're not stressing ourselves in some capacity, and yeah, 100 miles might be a little bit more than is necessary, but, you know, depends on what you like, but you have to stress your body, you have to stress your mind in order to be able to keep things functioning, and with that comes the risk of injury or overuse that you have to deal with. So the answer is not just, you know, sitting down waiting for everything to get better. Which leads me to something that I was contemplating as far as how do we achieve the best success with people. I've had people talk to me that they need accountability. They need somebody there at the gym or somebody there on the sidewalk waiting to walk with them. And that's the only way that they're going to get out of bed and do something. They have a class that they have to attend, the instructor's waiting for them, the trainer's waiting for them. They need detailed explanations of what to do and to check it off or it's not going to happen. There are other people that's a little different. And I kind of liken this to horses and donkeys. Many podcasts back, I had a discussion of donkey running with burro running, and they talked about if the burro doesn't think it's safe, no matter how safe it is, whether it's just crossing over a yellow line in the road, the burro is not going to go. So the burro needs coached in a specific way that the burro thinks it's safe and the burro thinks it's a good idea, and usually the burro does something on its own terms. You might know somebody like this, don't know. Typically, these are the people that don't do well with change and probably aren't going to do well at adopting lifestyle changes. And if they do, it's going to take a long time before they finally give in and decide to do it because they're just not convinced that it's the thing to do for them. On the other hand, horses are very trainable and are very coachable. But there are a variety of different horses with different mindsets. So you have the workhorse or the Clydesdale, relentless forward progress that's going to keep working on and on and on no matter what. And so they're not going to go real fast, maybe. They're a big animal, but they're going to keep plowing along and making steady forward progress. One step at a time, relentless forward progress. They're committed to the task at hand, going to get it done. Give them a little bit of direction and they'll keep going. That's everybody's dream person to work with and coach. So you educate them and they just keep going and making stride after stride after stride. And then you have a race, the racehorses, and I guess the thoroughbreds of things. And there are a variety of different animals that require good jockeys. So if you've ever watched the Kentucky Derby and listened to all the interviews with the jockeys on the day of the Kentucky Derby, you kind of find out that the jockey matters. The jockey that knows the horse the best, the trainer that knows the horse the best, but the jockey for the most part is key to the horse's success because he knows when to hold back and when to let the horse go. So sometimes people come into my office and they're going to be 100% perfect plant-based eaters right out of the get-go, and they just go out of the gate as fast as they possibly can, only to fall flat on their face when things don't go right and the first meal doesn't turn out right and they just, you know, plummet. This would be Seabiscuit in the early years, perhaps. And then there are horses that, again, are very love to run, just need to know when to go, when to be coached into, you know, what to do next, when to do it, and then let it rip. And, you know, again, these people are fun to work with. It's, you know, there's a little bit of a learning curve, but again, it's steady forward progress, a little faster, and they're very energetic and enthusiastic about trying new things that can make them do well. And then there's probably the horse that does better following somebody until the end when the jockey kind of lets the horse go and then they go around and they can do it. So the horse that needs to follow, or sometimes it could be the burro too. So that person needs a group setting and accountability in order to progress. And I think it's important for us to all understand, you know, what category we kind of fall into because it can help you decide what kind of coach you might like if you need a coach. I think everybody can benefit from some assessment, outside assessment of how they're doing on a particular goal or endeavor, especially if it's not their own expertise. So it helps for an outside set of eyes to, you know, look in and help people. One of the things that we like to do are kind of be nutritional detectives and find things that are in someone's diet that may be a source of salt or a source of oils or something that we can help people get back on the track and keep going and making steady progress. No one really sends the horse out by itself and, you know, just hang on and let it do what it wants. So we all need a little bit of guidance and encouragement. And so think about what kind of horse or donkey you might be, and perhaps we could work together, and we'd love to help encourage you in any way that you see fit. And I guess my last rant of the day is the Ozempic, Mounjaro, Wegovy, used to be diabetic medications, now weight loss medications, to the point where people can't get a hold of them. Everybody's using them. So it's almost like they're going to put this stuff in the water. We've cured obesity. I read today that Oprah is cutting ties with Weight Watchers because she's taking the medication and no need to, you know, it's not in your, it's not amount of, about willpower. It's about having a disease and you need to take this medication. So we're educating people that they have a disease, that they need to take medication for the rest of their lives in order to control this obesity epidemic that we have. And everybody's falling into the category. Why try when you can just take a medication? And even Weight Watchers has got into the online prescribing. So even there are telemedicine companies or pharmaceutical companies that are going directly to prescribing these medications without having any input or assessment by a physician in person or somebody that actually knows them. So if you want the medication, you can get it through Weight Watchers, you can get it through the drug companies, you know, if you can find, again, the supply and demand thing, but for the most part, you can get a hold of this medication pretty easily, and people do lose weight. If you look online and review pages and pages and pages up front, it talks about how these medications work by decreasing your brain's, and it's basically in the brainstem feedback loop to realize that you're hungry. So they're saying that the main problem with obesity is that you can't feel full, you don't have good signals. So if you take this medication, your brain's going to know it's full, and your brain's going to select kale over Snickers, and you'll lose weight and everything will be fine. It does perhaps increase your brainstem activity to make the feedback loop a little stronger in that you do feel more full. That's probably true. But what's also not talked about is if it's working at the level of the brainstem, it's also working at your vital functions at the level of the brainstem, heart rate included. So your heart rate actually goes up on the medication. Respirations actually go up on the medications. There's also a input to the stomach and intestines so they don't empty as well. There's the autonomic nervous system that lines the GI tract slows down so your body retains food so you truly are full. It's not just a feat. It's just not a chemical that's released that says you're full when you're not. You truly are full because you're not emptying your stomach contents. And the biggest side effects are GI at this point. So nausea, vomiting, perhaps diarrhea, pancreatitis, gallstones. Those are all potential side effects of this wonderful drug. Pancreatic cancer is a potential side effect, as is medullary carcinoma of the thyroid, because we're interfering with hormonal systems. People say you have to take it forever. There's been some studies when you come off of it, there's a certain percentage of people that will maintain as long as they exercise and eat a good diet. They can maintain their weight loss and maybe even lose a little bit more. But if people haven't changed the way they ate, they gain the weight back and they can gain the weight back more. So it's not the magic bullet pill that is going to be prescribed for a month or two, and then you go back to doing whatever you want. There has to be lifestyle changes with it in order for it to be long-term successful, and hopefully people can get off of it before the side effects start to accrue. Just like proton pump inhibitors are great at decreasing acid production in the stomach, so if you have reflux or indigestion, and you take a proton pump inhibitor, you can eat fire without having GI symptoms. So you can eat the onion rings and the hot dogs and all the greasy food, and your indigestion goes down and the acid goes down because it's blocked. You can't get off of it if you change your diet. You have to really wean it because your body adjusts to the system. The other thing that happens with the proton pump inhibitors is that it increases your risk for osteoporosis and increases your risk for a heart attack, and they're both black box warnings. It decreases your ability to absorb medication, as does the weight loss medications. So these wonderful drugs that do one thing have a backside to them, and it took a long time for the backside to come out for the proton pump inhibitors. They didn't come out for years and years and years that there was a problem with these medications that we prescribed like water. Now we're prescribing these weight loss medications like water, quick fix, cryotherapy for your weight loss, not addressing the real problem of what's going on and choices that we're making. We know that if you eat sweet, salty, fatty foods, you get a good dopamine, big dopamine release, you crave them more. Everybody does. That's the food manufacturers know that. So it's a matter of actually, just like being plant-based or even carnivore for that matter, putting fences around things that we know are bad for us. It's hard just to eat a little. You have to kind of avoid them. So medications aren't without side effects. Medications don't treat the root cause. They treat the symptoms. Maybe they work in the short term. Maybe they're going to save some people in the short term and give them the confidence to go on and change their diet and lifestyle. I hope they do. To date, there has not been any therapy for obesity that has done that. Life works its way around. So if you're on one of these medications or you're contemplating taking one of these medications, put parameters around the time. Make sure you're looking into light diet and exercise and changing and maximizing your nutrition. You wouldn't be listening to this podcast if you weren't trying to maximize your nutrition. Beware. So as always, we love to work with you, whether you take medication or you don't take medication. We're the real deal. We believe in diet, exercise, movement. We practice what we preach. We have mobility classes. We have yoga classes. I would just as soon talk about my ultra running as I would anything else. It's not pretend. We don't have pretend people. We have people in our practice that are running half marathons, any age from 40s to 88, and they're doing it successfully. Shout out to Beverly Larson, who's one of our members that's getting ready to run her first 5K on St. Patrick's Day at the age of 75 for her 75th birthday. So she's going to rock it. She's determined. She's getting her diabetes under control. She's getting fit, and she's in better shape than she was for a long time. And, you know, when I first met her, she said she didn't like to sweat. She didn't want to go outside. And here she is running the 5K. So it's never too late to turn things around, get on the start line, and improve your overall well-being and reverse the mechanisms of the things that are causing you problems. Thanks for listening. Head on over to our website, drdelaney.com, drdelaney, and see how we can help you. There's multiple ways to join the practice. Thank you, as always, for listening.